Welcome to the Mother Jones editorial briefing with Chris Mooney and Tim McDonnell. My name is Stephanie Green, and I'm the development manager here at Mother Jones. I'll also be moderating today's call. Today, we'll speak with two reporters for Climate Desk. For those not familiar, Climate Desk was formed in 2009 to fill the void in the media's climate coverage and to cover the human, environmental, economic, and political stories of climate change. It's a partnership of leading media outlets, including The Atlantic, Center for Investigative Reporting, Grist, the UK's Guardian, Mother Jones, of course, Slate, Wired, and most recently, The Huffington Post, bringing its potential reach to over 225 million readers monthly. Last year, Climate Desk shared more than 430 unique stories across its partner sites, including breaking news coverage of the devastating Yosemite wildfire, thoughtful analysis on climate policy, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, in-depth reporting on the latest developments in climate science, and much more. Climate Desk is truly a multimedia news organization. In 2013, it launched a podcast, Inquiring Minds, which is now the number two rated science podcast on iTunes and has received over 500,000 downloads. Without further ado, let me introduce our Climate Desk reporters. In addition to co-hosting Inquiring Minds, Chris Mooney also hosts the Climate Desk live event series and is a contributor to Climate Desk and Mother Jones. He's also the author of four books, including the New York Times bestselling The Republican War on Science. Tim McDonnell, who's also joining us today, is the associate producer for the Climate Desk and has been with the Climate Desk since its launch in 2009. Before moving to New York to head up the Climate Desk, Tim was part of the Ben Bechdikian Fellowship Program here in our San Francisco offices. So let's make sure we've got you both on the line. Tim and Chris, are you available?
Hi, hello.
I'm here.
Yeah, okay, seems great. Like it.
Okay, fantastic. So just a bit of housekeeping before we get started with our Q&A. All callers are muted. If you would like to ask a question, please press *9 on your phone. When you have been unmuted, you will hear a prompt that you've been released to speak, and I will ask you to introduce yourself. We welcome and encourage questions at any time throughout the briefing, but we'll also reserve some time at the end of the call for a formal Q&A. Please keep your questions concise and avoid using speakerphone if possible so all participants can hear you. If we do not get to your question during the call today, you'll have the opportunity to ask them of Chris and Tim later via email. So, all right, let's get started. Chris and Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll start with a question for both of you. There's been a lot of talk about extreme weather this winter. So the big question in climate coverage is how do you get people to care about more than just the weather?
Chris, you did. Go for it, Chris.
I don't know. The weather works so well. It's hard to think beyond that, especially the last 2 months. But I think that there are other stories that we have written that have gotten as much attention that weren't attached directly to weather events, such as just telling people in a very usable way what the latest science says on global warming. You know, when we had a story called Here are five terrifying statements from the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that really just boiled it down, and that was hugely popular. Also, I think, and Tim can tell you more, telling stories is often as effective as piggybacking on the weather.
I'd agree with that. Yeah, I would say that for us, you know, we're really interested in weather-related stories kind of for two reasons. Like Chris mentioned before, first reason is that, you know, people, despite the fact that weather kind of strangely is sort of the poster child for, you know, conversations that are like kind of mundane, like asking about how the weather's going. But actually, it's actually incredibly fascinating, especially in the context of climate change. And we find that from just from a sort of traffic perspective, these stories about weather, which Chris does such a great job on, tend to do really well. They go viral. This is a topic that people really care about. And Stephanie, to answer, you know, your question, the other way that weather stories are really important for us is that they do provide a window, a really tangible window into the larger issues of climate change, which, you know, for a lot of people, I think, are still kind of abstract. And climate change is something that happens, you know, on such a global scale. It happens over a really long period of time. So often it can be difficult to really wrap your mind around. And although it's certainly true that, you know, weather is sort of only one piece of the climate and, you know, isn't necessarily always tied to, you know, human-caused climate change, stories about what's happening with the weather, whether climate change is a factor or not, these are ways we find to really bring people bring more people into the conversation or preach beyond the choir, because these weather stories have such a large following. So once you get people kind of interested in talking about climate change through stories about the weather, it can be a way to get them to also stay around and learn more about, you know, atmospheric science or about energy policy or about things that they might not have been interested in beforehand, but that they can come to because of these stories about weather.
Fantastic. Obviously, you know, weather has been a big story in the last few months with the Arctic being drunk, and now we're finally getting a little bit of rain here in California. And I know that those stories did really well for us. What are some of the stories that you've been surprised with in terms of how little or how much people were paying attention that weren't necessarily about the weather? Tim, do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, one thing that I've been, I don't know if I'm necessarily surprised at this or not, but one thing that I've been kind of paying close attention to are all the different facets of the president's climate plan that he announced last summer, in particular, the sort of ways in which he's moving forward on putting more caps on carbon pollution from coal plants and really trying to cut down on the amount of carbon pollution from that source. I think it's an issue that really is probably the most important facet of Obama's climate plan, trying to cut back on carbon emissions from our biggest sources of carbon emissions. But that can be a story that, it's the most, probably the most significant piece of the puzzle that he's pushing right now. It can be hard to get people to really engage with that because, again, coal-fired power plants are kind of boring and people don't really interact with them in a normal basis. So it's not surprising to me that would be a subject that would be hard to get people interested in. But that's kind of the challenge that we have is, you know, it's our job to know what really are the most important things that are happening and to understand them. And then, you know, as communicators, then the next step is to try to frame stories around those things that help really get people engaged with them.
Right. Chris?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, just generally, unfortunately, it is the case that you're writing about policy, especially the intricacies of regulatory policy and how you're going to cap emissions or how one proposes to cap emissions. It's very hard to get the drama out of that. And so in general, we don't see as much overall interest in those kind of stories, just like Tim said. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't do them or that we shouldn't do them, and they are actually very important to what's happening on the issue overall. But certainly we find that interest is heightened by other things that don't have as much to do with policy. Weather is certainly one of them. Another one that's very important is when a big scientific event happens. So, you know, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was really, really a big deal. And so we, you know, covered it in many, many ways. In fact, Tim was over in Stockholm covering it. So there you see attention get focused, and then you see a lot more people getting interested.
Great. Yep. Tim, let's talk about one story in particular. Keystone is heating up again. Can you give us an update on where things stand?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So basically, the point that we're at here with Keystone is that a few weeks ago, we saw the release of a long-awaited environmental impact report from the State Department that was sort of meant to look at, you know, what are some of the environmental impacts of the pipeline, everything from sort of spill potential all the way up to, you know, global climate change from carbon emissions that might result from exploiting this tar sands oil resource up in Canada. And this was sort of a report that's been in the works for a long time. There was an earlier draft of it that was released a few months beforehand that was kind of criticized for ignoring the carbon emissions part of things. So now this is the final report that's come out. This is what's sitting with the president. We're also still waiting for another report from the State Department's Inspector General, which was looking into whether there might have been a conflict of interest in the third-party contractors that carried out some of the research on this report. There's some suspicion that those contractors had been kind of working previously with TransCanada, the company trying to build the pipeline, so there might be a conflict of interest there. But we're sort of still waiting to see how that will pan out. So basically, you know, at this point, the president has this final report. We're in a period right now where other government agencies and the general public are able to give feedback on this report before a final decision gets made. There's no real deadline for the president about when he has to make a decision about this. I think, you know, Canadian officials and certainly the company are pushing for him to make a decision. I mean, as well as many politicians in the U.S. are pushing for him to make a decision, you know, immediately, tomorrow, later today. But I'm not holding my breath, really. I mean, the president has managed to push this down the line for several years now. I mean, this project, you know, was first talked about back in, 2008. There's been a lot of time leading up to this, but that's sort of the point that we're at now. And last thing I'll say about it is that the most significant takeaway from the State Department report that I've mentioned is that it does look at the carbon emissions. The president has said that whether or not the pipeline will lead to an increase in carbon emissions is going to be one of his key criteria, if not the most important criteria for him in deciding whether to approve the pipeline. And this report, it's been construed many different ways depending on who you ask. But one reading of the report that's kind of come out is that they're saying that the carbon emissions from this oil resource are going to happen with or without the pipeline if the oil is extracted through rail or trucks or other pipelines or other means. And so that question is not really settled about whether the building the pipe would actually lead to an increase in emissions or not. And I mean, it kind of, like I said, it depends on who you ask. So I think, now we're at the point where the president is looking at that, kind of weighing that decision, and then, hopefully we'll have a final answer sometime this year, I'm hoping.
Okay, great. While we're on the
sorry, that was probably more than you would have wanted.
No, that's fantastic. I mean, this is why you are do what you do, Tim. You are an expert in the field. While we are on the subject of Washington, let's talk a little bit about Tom Steyer, who's pledged to spend $100 million during the 2014 midterms to address climate change. How do you guys think this is going to affect the run-up to the elections, and will it have any long-term effects?
Chris, you want to go for that one?
I don't know a ton about that one. However, sure, $100 million is a lot of money. And I personally believe that we ought to focus a lot more on scientific issues, not just climate change, in an electoral context. I feel that, politicians do not get held to account as they're running for office for some of their reality-detached opinions enough. And so anything that draws attention to those, I think, is a good thing, because increasingly what we find is that when you get in office, it turns out that your ability to think critically about evidence in the world around you is sort of a very vital part of being a leader. And yet we don't really generally think that's part of the job description. Well, it ought to be. And climate change is sort of one of the major litmus tests for this. So, I think it's very important.
I'd agree with that. And I would also add that, for the longest time now, ever since sort of climate change has been an issue in the public debate, most of the money swirling around the climate change issue has been on the, opposition side, from people like the Koch brothers, other kind of fossil fuel invested interests who have been pushing against the basic science, pushing against any kind of policy. And so, I think it can be worthwhile to at least have a little bit of money now on the other side of the fence, trying to push for this to become more widely accepted rather than sort of suppressed. So if there's one positive outcome, I mean, regardless of what you might think about Tom Steyer, I think, having some kind of investment in the political sphere to, on the sort of believing in climate change side of things, I think is good and useful.
Great. Once again, I'll remind our callers that we welcome questions at any time. So if you would like to ask a question of Tim or Chris, please dial *9 on your phone. Let's go back to individuals who are working to either bring awareness of climate change or to address its effects. Are there other surprising individuals or companies championing environmental change and making real progress that we might not know about?
Well, I'll take a stab at one that I've covered recently, which is Wall Street. I mean, I think it's been fascinating to see how some of the most progressive thinking about, how are we actually going to persist and thrive in a world with climate change is coming from, huge multinational banks, development banks, some of the biggest sort of pots of money in America and across the world. These are people that are thinking about, where are we putting our investments, and where are there opportunities to, to be honest, to make a profit from helping the world to kind of both mitigate the sources of pollution that cause climate change and also adapt to a world where, some of these changes are already locked in. We're seeing flooding, droughts, fires, all these impacts that we cover, we're seeing these things already. And so I think there's been a great and growing interest in finding ways for banks to put their money sort of into climate change. And there's really very much a growing awareness of the issue. And I mean, it's being talked about openly on Wall Street, which is something that I think is really surprising, especially because we tend to think of sort of giant fossil fuel producing corporations as, you know, maybe the bad guys in the climate change story. But actually, you know, some of the private sector companies who really are in control of the most money are really taking this issue very seriously, and actually being engaged with it on a frank, serious level that, you know, you don't often see in Congress, for example, or elsewhere. So I think that's been surprising to me and really fascinating. And
yeah,
something
I agree
that we plan
with that.
To continue, something that we plan to continue to cover much into the future.
Hey, you forget to mention something else that you covered, which is another industry that really cares, the ski industry. You did a really great piece on that. Yeah, no, that, you know, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, it really did look like it was corporations against the climate. The number of corporations and their unity in terms of really obfuscating about the problem, it was just much bigger and it was much more monolithic. And that broke down steadily over time, and it's really hard to say that all of corporate America is the problem anymore. I mean, there's just so many companies that are being pretty progressive in various ways on climate change, from Intel, you know, to Coca-Cola. So, I mean, there are still, you know, sort of foot draggers, and there are deniers, but it isn't a consensus anymore in the business world, because ultimately business people are most of the time, you know, pretty smart and realize that they have to see what's coming ahead of them. And for a multinational company, this is something that has to be factored into their decisions.
One other thing I would add that we've done a little bit on in the past, which I think is really interesting along these lines, is looking at what the U.S. military is doing to prepare for this. You know, it's now sort of widely discussed, and there have been a few reports from really the upper echelons of the U.S. military that identify climate change specifically as a real, serious, and growing national security risk. And the ways in which the military is kind of preparing for or learning how to deal with climate change, I think, are really interesting. I mean, there are a lot of naval ports in the U.S. and around the world that are at risk from rising sea levels. The Navy has a big campaign right now to be using a lot more biofuels. They're equipping the Army is equipping soldiers with solar panels that they can use for energy out in the field and cut down on the massive amount of oil that they typically use out in the field. So actually seeing the way that the military and sort of the entire national security apparatus is dealing with climate change. I mean, even just the fact that they are talking about this as a real issue, I think, is really telling and really fascinating.
And encouraging. Let's switch gears just a little bit and talk about the climate desk and how unique it is. The Huffington Post recently became a partner of the Climate Desk, which means that each story has the potential to reach millions of readers via our partner channels. Can you talk a little bit about how this partnership helps you guys do your work?
Yeah, I guess I can take that on. So the Climate Desk is just what you said, a partnership, and what it means is that we create our own content and we share it with our various partners, including the Huffington Post, Slate, Wired, The Atlantic, Guardian, numerous others, Grist. But also then their content can also be run by the other, you know, any partner. So, you know, their content might appear at Mother Jones. So what it means is that the potential impact for a story is greater. And I'll just give you one example. This is actually not a climate story, because I do this sort of like psychology of politics, because that's a lot of fun. And sometimes it's climate related and sometimes it isn't. So I did something about why internet trolls are Machiavellian sadists based upon actual psychological tests that were administered to people who said they like to be trolls. And it turned out that was somehow, you know, hugely a viral article at Slate, but actually not at our site. But the point is they could use it because it was under the Climate Desk name. So it lets content travel a lot farther. And sometimes you will see your particular article show up, I don't know, four times, five times. That's sort of the maximum that I've ever seen. But it does mean that you can have a much bigger impact.
Great.
I'd agree. And I think I would add to that too, that, you know, it's not just that these stories are being shared more widely, but also that what we do, the type of content that we produce here at Climate Desk, I think really is unique. And as someone who spends a lot of time, you know, reading the environmental press, reading other websites, you know, other climate related blogs, I feel very confident saying that we do something here that no one else is doing. I think our videos in particular, no one else is doing web videos the way that we do. I mean, we are going neck deep into the places where these issues are the most, you know, where it's really happening, the places where these issues are the most tangible, bringing back reports from the field, producing video content that really is not, no one else is doing anything like this. And I could say the same thing about Chris's podcast, which has done so well. You know, this is, it's really a unique thing. And this is, by the way, what we're doing with, there are four of us who work full time on Climate Desk. And I think that we were able to do kind of a remarkable amount with that, with a staff of that size. And I think that this is content that, you know, it's not just the same type of climate blogging that you might get at other places. The take that we have on it, I think, really is unique. And the multimedia level that we're able to bring to it really, really isn't being done anywhere else. And I think that adds immensely to people's interest in and ability to engage more closely with the topic of climate change.
Yeah, and on top of that, just one more thing that I think we do well and, you know, that other people are not able to do is that we have, you know, thankfully, under the umbrella of Foundation for National Progress and Mother Jones, we have really talented data visualization and even data analysis people. So some of the stories come with charts, figures, graphs that make them all make just a lot more sense and that make them more readable and more shareable. And I think we do that really well too. And you need that for scientific stories.
Well, you answered my next question already. I didn't even have to ask it. We do use video and charts and graphics, and those, you know, we see those being shared across Facebook and Twitter and things like that. Chris, can you talk a little bit more about how you've been using the other two ways that we share our stories, Climate Desk Live and Inquiring Minds? How are those helping you do your work?
Sure. Well, these are the projects that I take on in addition to just being a journalist and reporting. And so let's start with Inquiring Minds. Inquiring Minds has been sort of my baby for the last 5 months. I am thrilled at what has happened with it and how it just sort of blew up. It seems like there was a, you know, wide open space for us to drive a truck through here. You know, I guess, you know, science content for podcasts is not, the demand is not satisfied. And so Inquiring Minds is a show that I co-host with Indre Viscontis, who is a brilliant mind, a neuroscientist, and also a musician, an opera singer. And we both...
And a new mother on top of everything else.
And a new mom. And we sort of... What was great about the show is that, you know, she was actually... Because we chat about what's interesting in science that week. And so she was finding all these amazing... stories about kids and, you know, whether you should show them mobile devices or whether it's bad for their brains. Like, she was doing her research on the show, and so I think a lot of the listeners got engaged because of that. She was very, very thorough, and that was very impressive. But then the centerpiece of the show is always the in-depth interview with the big brain guest, sort of like the Terry Gross of science. And sometimes the most recent show is actually a debate about what global warming is doing to the weather between scientists who disagree. But sometimes it'll be a celebrity. Sometimes it'll be just someone who has a really brilliant take on things. You know, we had Carrie Byron from Mythbusters. We just had her on. We had Michael Pollan. We had Mark Ruffalo. So some celebs, some really big names. But sometimes it'll be someone who, you know, we know their research is fascinating and we're just, you know, glad to have the opportunity to get them to talk for a while, and then we can sort of write a story that goes with it that really surprises people. So one of the, and I should add, we cover climate, but we don't just cover climate. We cover whatever is of interest at the intersection of science and politics. And one of our most popular shows was a show where you couldn't say that the guest was a gigantic big name, but it just asked a question that fascinated people, which is, why is it that, you know, the vast majority of the world believes in God, but there's this really substantial minority that doesn't, called atheists, and they're in every country. And so why does this configuration show up? And it turns out we had a researcher who does the psychology of why some people don't believe and everybody else does. And there are all these psychological traits that tend to accompany here. So that was, people loved that. And so it's about asking questions and seeing who the best person is to answer them. That's what we do.
Fantastic. Can you talk a little bit about Climate Desk Live?
Oh, sorry. I was getting carried away. So Climate Desk Live is the other project that I run. And basically here we are convening events, usually in D.C., but they can be anywhere, where this time we are in front of people in an auditorium and I'm hosting, and we're again having some of the most important thinkers about climate change or about energy come on in and talk to us. And so we've had, you know, Michael Mann, the famed climate scientist who's behind the hockey stick study, which everybody kind of knows is sort of the iconic image of climate change. You know, we had him at one of those events. We had another event that was really experimental and really different. Tim, I think, was there in D.C. where we had sort of a live series of talks by people who you'd never heard of, but who were trying in a variety of ways to figure out how to communicate climate change so that it stuck. And this was an evening event, and there was even, you know, a bar at the back, and there was a DJ and stuff like that. And it was called, you know, Thirst, you know, which is a DC event series, sort of science cafe at night meets Climate Desk. And we had sort of, I think, really some really cool talks there. So it's a live event, and we're constantly thinking up new ways to do them and great people who can come and speak at them.
Fantastic. Okay, well, you know, at this point, I would like to open up the formal question and answer session with our callers. Again, if you have a question for Tim or Chris, please dial *9, and then you will get a little prompt that you have been unmuted so that you can ask your question. Again, I'll ask you try to not use speakerphone so that all of our callers can hear you clearly. Do we have any questions? We'll give people a couple of minutes to gather their thoughts. Okay, we've got a question. We'll wait for the technology to catch up. It looks like we're having a little bit of a problem with the call. Hold on just a moment.
Hello?
Hi, okay, now we can hear you.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I had a question about, you know, the response from the people that you're covering on the ground as it relates to their perception of climate change. You know, I know you've traveled, you know, to various parts of the country, you know, and experienced, you know, people discussing, you know, rising seas or, you know, the effects of fracking. And I'm curious if they're relating it to climate change as well, or kind of what the perceptions you're seeing from the people who are actually being affected by, you know, climate change.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question.
Probably Tim,
yeah. Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and one that James West, the other producer, and myself are always really kind of interested to see how that pans out when we go out into the field. I mean, it runs the complete range. I mean, we have people, you know, you can have people whose house was just burned down by an insane wildfire in Colorado, or whose house is about to be inundated by tidal flooding in Virginia, who totally don't believe in any way that climate change has anything to do with human activity. They think it's caused by, you know, solar cycles, or that it's just not happening, or I don't know what. I mean, but then, you know, but you also get people who are absolutely convinced that what they've experienced with their own, you know, two eyes in their own backyard, that this, you know, this is something that we are causing. I mean, and so it really runs the complete range. I think it helps us actually to be in the field and to see what people are really thinking about this issue. I mean, it helps us to frame our stories in a way that will help reach more people, to break down some of those barriers. Because, you know, if you just live in, you know, the sort of the climate change bubble, of reporters like us, you know, it's easy to kind of lose sight of what people actually think about the issue. But going out there, is always informative to us, and it really runs the complete spectrum.
Great. Okay, it looks like we have another question.
It seems that a lot of scientists have chosen to stay on the sidelines rather than wading into the debate for reasons of protecting the integrity of the research. Do you think it's high time that scientists get off the sideline and get into the debate as activists?
I'll take that one. First, I don't know if it's true anymore that scientists stay on the sidelines. I think there's a split now. I think the trend is towards more scientists getting off the sidelines, and there's huge amounts of energy being expended at scientific organizations and scientific conferences like the American Geophysical Union meeting every year in talking about what exactly that looks like and what it should be. And that word you used, activist, is one of the words that's needs to be defined for them. I mean, they're uncomfortable with it, but another word that scientists are uncomfortable that's related is advocacy. They don't want to be seen as impartial and biased. And yet if you define advocacy differently as standing up for the integrity of your knowledge and making sure that it gets taken seriously, then they probably don't have much of a problem with it. It's just advocacy for specific legislation or something that makes them a little bit leery. And I can understand that. So there's all kinds of engagement that they can do. And they all need to figure out their comfort zone. I mean, Michael Mann, I mentioned him earlier, he was actually involved in campaigning in the Virginia gubernatorial race. So that's maybe one kind of political engagement that I think really could be called activism. But a lot of scientists just want to be understood and or want their research to not be attacked. And if it's attacked, they want to clarify, they want to set the record straight, and then that might actually activate them and mobilize them to want to do more. I don't think we know the full impact right now of scientists not talking or talking. You know, I think that it's actually something that what's happening is increasing amount of research on communication is actually looking at consequences of doing it and doing it well and doing it poorly and what impact it has. And I don't think we actually know. I mean, it's a gigantic global debate with huge numbers of voices, many of which are voices that drown out climate scientists. You know, I mean, the voice of someone like, say, Al Gore or Arnold Schwarzenegger or something like that. We don't really know what impact they're having or, you know, what strategies are best. So they're sort of feeling their way, I think, a little bit.
I agree with that, Chris. And I would add that at the same time, I think something that some scientists are struggling with some of the baggage that comes along when you do step, you know, a little bit more into the activism realm. I mean, you mentioned Michael Mann. I mean, he's received death threats for the work that he's done. Other scientists have been subjected to Freedom of Information Act requests for their emails between scientists, which, you know, can compromise the sort of basic scientific process. James Hansen, who's one of the best known climate scientists, you know, eventually had to he made the decision to step down from his job at NASA because, you know, he wanted to have more flexibility to do activism and didn't want to be tied down to a government position where he wouldn't be able to speak as much. So I think that, you know, when you as a scientist, you know, you have to make a decision at a certain point, I think, about, you know, whether you want to really be able to focus exclusively on just doing research, which, you know, what got you into the field to begin with. And then if you're willing to deal with some of the consequences that can potentially come along when you step outside of that realm and how, you know, whether you think that's worth it.
Okay, thanks so much. Just a reminder, in order to ask questions, you'll need to dial *9 on your phone. And I do ask that you please introduce yourself so we can see who is on the call with us. I'll give people a few minutes to gather their thoughts. Well, I know I have a question for you guys. I want to go back a little bit to one of the stories that we were covering quite a bit on multiple partner sites, which was the tragedy in West Virginia and the pollution of their water supply. We used video a lot in those stories to tell the story more broadly. Can you, and I know you talked a little bit about this, Tim, but since you've been at the forefront of the climate desk since the beginning, can you talk about why we really chose to use these different ways of telling the stories and how they help tell the stories that need to be told?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, in the case of the West Virginia story, it is actually, I think, a good example because it does kind of reveal how the Climate Desk has evolved its relationship with our partners over time. I mean, the original idea for going down to West Virginia and doing a sort of 1 month later follow-up story and doing these video pieces, actually, the idea originally came from Suzanne Goldenberg at The Guardian, who has really been, she's their chief, for those of you who don't know, she's their sort of chief environment reporter based in the U.S., in D.C. She's amazing, fantastic journalist, total veteran, and it was her idea. And she has been really interested recently, more and more so, in tapping into the resource that the Climate Desk provides as far as doing additional multimedia production and getting either James or myself to come along with her on the road. We would love to be able to develop relationships like that. I mean, and I think we're going to be doing this more and more with The Guardian, which is great. I mean, that's amazing for the footprint that our work has. It's strengthening relationships between journalists on so many different levels. I mean, it's really what the Climate Desk partnership is all about, and we really hope to see more of that, you know, happening, these close partnerships with individual reporters or just broadly with our other publications. And I think the West Virginia story was really just an opportunity to, you know, go down and, you know, again, as this is something that we really value, is being able to tell personal stories right from the ground, how this is really affecting people's lives. And it happened to tie nicely, very nicely, into a piece that Chris had just done, I think an Inquiring Minds piece, right, about the chemical industry. Actually, I remember the day that it happened, it was like oddly good timing, or I mean, I shouldn't say good, it's a tragedy, but
well, actually what happened is
the timing
that
worked out, yeah.
It didn't, but then I came back to it. So we had on Deborah Blum, who's written this fascinating book that just did a PBS special about the origins of forensic chemistry back in the 20s and in Jazz Age in New York, and basically the first forensic chemists who were the precursors of all of the, you know, people that you see on these TV dramas now who are constantly using, you know, science to catch the bad guy. And so I had her on to talk about that because it's a wonderful story. But then the West Virginia thing happened, and I didn't get to ask her about it because it was too late. But so I just called her up again and did a whole separate article asking her to figure out what is this chemical that's now in the water. And she was actually pretty good at doing that. And the story just took off from there and is still going. So.
Yep.
Great. Yeah. Again, if you have questions for Tim or Chris, please dial *9. We actually have a question via email. Someone is asking, this is probably directed towards you, Tim, if back to the debate about Keystone, since it seems like some people might think that it is a dead-end strategy, whether the environmental movement has picked the right target in really making Keystone a subject of debate.
That is the big question.
It's a big question. It's great. It's a really insightful question, and it's something that we have debated amongst ourselves here internally on our little internal messaging thing here at work. But I think there's a lot of different ways to answer the question, and again, it just sort of depends on who you talk to. I think, you know, when you ask, if you were to ask that question to Bill McKibben, who I'm sure most of you know is the director of 350.org, also a former journalist, who's the one, him and Michael Bruin at the Sierra Club have really been the ones really leading the charge against Keystone. If you ask them this question, as I have, you know, their response is that this pipeline is so important that it's worth investing this much time into fighting. And also, you know, that the environmental movement needs something, a rallying point. They need a way to get, you know, and I forget who it was. Somebody's, you know, I saw something, a comment somebody left online to the effect of, you know, you're not going to have people, marching through the streets chanting for, you know, coal-fired power plant carbon regulations. You need to have something like a pipeline or a project that people can sort of rally around and use that to draw more attention to the larger issue. I think, of course, at the same time, it's true that, you know, if this pipeline doesn't go through, we're not going to stop using oil. There will be other pipelines. There's going to be other projects. It doesn't really solve the long-term problem to just block this one project. And of course, any environmental, you know, strategy that revolves around a single piece of infrastructure has, I think, limited applications. And so I think that's kind of the challenge that we'll see. And I would wonder, I would be curious to see too, you know, what will happen, what might happen to the sort of the momentum that the environmental movement has so far gained around Keystone if the president decides to approve it. I mean, what happens to that momentum then? Is that lost? I mean, I have no idea. But I think that that's really fascinating. And I think now that there is sort of, I mean, just the other day, the editor of Science, the journal Science, came out in favor of the pipeline. So there is a shift, you know, that's happening. More people, Jonathan Chait at New York Magazine has come out in favor of the pipeline. So there, you know, I think there are people that are kind of really starting to scratch their heads about, is this really the best strategy? But again, for the people who are the most at the forefront of the issue, they still think that it is the right way to go.
Yeah, let me just add, I mean, I think what's hard about this issue is that the decision itself depends upon various kinds of technical policy related matters that are not necessarily essential to how you feel about the overall climate issue, but that are in play because it's an international issue. And because it involves the State Department, all these sort of things. And so, you know, if this new report ends up being the thing that basically wins it for the pro-pipeline people, it's going to be because of a sort of, to my mind, I don't know if I want to call it technical, but a reason that you wouldn't want to be the reason that you either succeed or fail on an issue, which is just going to be that, oh, well, it turns out that the you know, the stuff's going to get out of the ground anyway, and it's going to be transported by trains if there's no pipeline. So, you know, it's a wash. So therefore, that's going to be I mean, you know, it's not very motivating at all if that ends up being the kind of, again, I don't know if technicality is the right word, but the reason. But when you look at how issues play out, Tim has written about this way more than me, but this is the one take that I thought that I contributed. When you look at how issues play out like this one, then it's possible to see that probably whatever happens with the pipeline, the fact that so much energy was expended on it means that there's going to be an effect on how the climate issue itself plays out, even if the people who don't want there to be a pipeline don't get what they want. In fact, you know, there might be more progress on climate change because they don't get what they want. There's all this research on what's called radical flank effects in social movements, where basically, you know, policymakers, in this case President Obama, sort of turn down what's seen as the radical option, which in this case would be, you know, actually blocking a pipeline and getting Canada really angry and stuff, turn that down so that they can then say, I'm not doing this thing, but instead I'm going to this more centrist thing, which is going to be taking on power plants and doing all of that stuff to actually cut emissions from domestic sources. So, you know, in some ways, it helps progress, even if they don't get what they actually wanted, which is sort of the paradox facing activists in a lot of issues, not just this one.
Really interesting point. Once again, if you have a question for Tim or Chris, please dial *9. We have another question via email. And someone is asking you to talk a little bit about the pros and cons of nuclear energy and how that relates to climate change.
Well, I could take that one on. So
sure,
my understanding, and I'm by no means someone who's done exhaustive reporting on nuclear, but I wrote about it in my last book. I've podcasted about it, not for Inquiring Minds, but for a prior show. I have some understanding of it, and my sense is that, first of all, the main issues with nuclear power tend to be economic, not actually health-related. In other words, it's really pretty safe, and even in the case of, you know, big disasters like a Fukushima or something like that, a Three Mile Island, you might actually have some people that get cancer because of radiation later on in their lives because there's been some radiation emitted, but it's nothing like the number of people that die every year from particulate pollution from coal-fired power plants. So, I mean, you know, you know, nuclear power, and nuclear power is not giving off all these greenhouse gas emissions either. So there's a lot of really good things about nuclear power, and there's been a lot of unjustified scaremongering about it. But if you can't make it work from a dollars and cents perspective, which is where I understand a lot of the real issues are, then it remains a problem. And I'm no economist, but again, the people who I think are smart about this have reinforced to me again and again that, yeah, the health case, you know, the safety case is pretty overblown, but the economic case isn't. So that's my understanding of where it stands.
And I think that the evidence for that is the fact that, you know, how many nuclear power plants are we building in the U.S. right now? I mean, I think you just have to look that there's not a lot of momentum behind this technology. And I think, as Chris said, you know, it's because of the money. Instead, the federal policy is pushing a lot more towards fracking, towards building natural gas-fired power plants, towards investing in renewables, because these are the things that are actually turning a profit. I mean, which is great. I mean, that's the kind of solution that's going to end up driving, you know, low carbon energy solutions that can help us, you know, I mean, prevent or slow climate change from happening. So that's another reason why I think nuclear is often less of an issue for us, because it's not as much of an active debate in the public sphere as some of these other forms of energy. But of course, you know, but it's totally fascinating. But I'm also looking, we have looked at nuclear to the extent that I was in Germany this fall looking at what's happening with their green energy transition, which of course has a lot to do with nuclear, because they've made the decision as a country to phase out their nuclear plants completely just within about a decade from now. They're working aggressively to shut down nuclear plants. And one of the effects of that is that they're burning more coal. So I think there's a lot of different ways that this issue can play out. And I would also just add that, you know, this is something that has kind of been interesting to see play out with, again, James Hansen, who's a huge proponent of using nuclear power, but that's definitely lost him some friends on the environmental movement. But whether that's justified, as Chris said, I think is kind of an open question.
Yeah, I think you have to watch it, because there are clearly some societies like France, for instance, that use a huge amount of nuclear power, are totally okay with it, and are doing pretty well. And there's always a potential for finding better ways of getting, you know, better and safer reactor technologies. So I think that, you know, in terms of the importance of this to the energy future, I think it's not going away. But you know, in the U.S., it's absolutely right that we're not really doing that much with nuclear to change the composition of the total energy that we get.
Great. Okay, so we are getting close to the end of the hour, so I'll remind callers, if you have a question you've been holding on to, you've been a little quiet so far, now is the time to ask it. Just dial *9 and you will be able to talk directly with Chris or Tim. Oh, here we go. We have a question. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Gabby. I'm a supporter of Climate Desk, and I was actually just wanted to go back to what you were saying about the potential progress overall that can result out of a failure in a particular issue. I was wondering what you think Obama can actually achieve with just 2 years left.
Well, it's all going to be it's all about, it's sort of a bureaucratic race, if that's sort of an oxymoron, right? I mean, you know, to get things done at the Environmental Protection Agency to put in place the greenhouse gas regulations. And I have not been watching closely those inevitably missed deadlines at the agency. But, you know, it seems like legally it can be done, and it's more about turning the really, really slow turning wheels of government. Can it be fully in place in a way that it can't be, you know, unmade in 2 years? I don't know the answer to that. There's people smarter than me who probably do.
Yeah, I think that the carbon emissions rules are really important. I mean, I think that in the sort of long game, the steps that the president takes to kind of push the EPA to exercise its regulatory authority over things like emissions standards, not just for power plants, but also for cars and trucks, things like that. These things might seem piecemeal compared to blocking, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline, for example. But I think that in the long game, these things are actually going to be much more important. And I would point out too, you know, it's, I think, a really interesting statistic that actually the new heavy duty truck standards that the president has pushed through, that are, these are increasing fuel efficiency for heavy duty trucks like semis, you know, big trucks on the road, which are also a huge source of carbon pollution. The idea with these is that over the long term, they're actually designed to save more in oil than the amount of oil that would be brought through the Keystone pipeline. And these are emissions limits that are going, these are being pushed through right now. So I think there's still a lot that he can do with stuff like that, even in 2 years. And like Chris said, you know, it kind of, I mean, who knows whether any of this will stick in the next administration or, you know, what might be done. I mean, that's impossible to say, but I think there's still,
well, we
time
can say that. Yeah, if there's a Democratic president after President Obama, then I think that it's super safe. I mean,
yeah, sure. Know. Yeah.
That's
sure.
I mean, I think that's pretty apparent. I mean, obviously the composition of Congress matters too, but.
And I would also just add, just as a last point too, that, you know, President Obama, regardless of what you think about anything else that he does, I mean, has been undoubtedly the most vocal president about climate change we've ever had. I don't think that's debatable. I think that that type of leadership, you know, I mean, just, you know, the bully pulpit, you know, I think that that type of leadership can really have an impact on the way that people are engaging with this issue. So even if it's not something that's attached to a certain piece of regulation or an executive order or what have you, you know, if the president continues to be as forthright and vocal about the issue as he has been, at least in the last year or so, I mean, if that continues for the next couple of years, I think that that could have great ramifications.
Great. Thank you for your question, Gabby. Well, unfortunately, it looks like we are reaching the end of the hour, and we are going to need to wrap up. Thank you so much for your participation and joining us to talk with Chris and Tim. Thank you, Chris and Tim, for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us.
Thank you.
I will be sending a follow-up email to all of the callers by the end of the day so that you have an opportunity to ask any outstanding questions if you didn't get the chance to ask them of Tim and Chris. And of course, we also welcome any feedback or thoughts on how we can continue to improve these briefings. I will also be sending you a link to a recording of the conversation once it becomes available so that you can share this conversation with your network. And if you haven't already, I do encourage you to follow both Chris and Tim on Twitter. In addition to their reporting, they're also great social media strategists and have a very fun feed. So thank you again, Chris and Tim. We really appreciate it. And thank you again for participating from all of us at Southern Jones. Many thanks for being a member of the community. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.